Senate Education and General Government Committee, welcome. Please turn off all your cell phones, PDAs, anything that makes noise. And sign-up sheets are over on the right, your left. We have a really tight agenda, so I'm going to be cutting people off if the testimony goes too far because we just got messed up here. We were supposed to be able to start at 8, and we couldn't, so we are very short on time today. So welcome. And we're going to start out with 609, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, we're going to start out by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 609. Ms. Richardson, what's going on?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 609 establishes the Frontier Education Outpost made up of three existing education service districts. It specifies the duties of the outpost and the method of determining the administrative office location. It requires education service districts to contribute funds for the operation of the outpost. It specifies a minimum amount of general purpose grant from the state school fund for outpost member districts. It declares an emergency and take effect upon passage. We have dash ones, dash twos, and dash threes before. Shall I cover those?
Just why don't you briefly talk about those?
I'll do my best.
Thanks.
Dash 1 removes the outpost member districts from the definition of an education service district if their local revenues meet or exceed $1 million. And it removes the minimum amount of general purpose grant from the state school fund for each of the outpost members. It specifies that outpost member districts may receive state school fund distributions that, in combination with local revenues, equal $1 million. It exempts these amounts from the state school fund calculation. The dash 2 is a gut and stuff. It removes the provisions establishing the Frontier Education Outpost, requires the state school fund distribution to education service districts to be, in combination with local revenue, no less than $1 million. It declares an emergency. The dash 3s are the same as the dash 1s, except that they require the state school fund distribution to education service districts to be, in combination with local revenue, no less than $1 million. The bill has a subsequent referral to finance and revenue. And members, you do also have a revenue statement on the bill itself.
All right. Thank you. We've got 25 minutes allocated for this hearing. So, Senator Nelson, why don't you come up and kick it off?
Thank you, Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator. I represent four counties in Northeast Oregon, District 29. One of them, which is Willow County, is one of the proponents of the Frontier ESD. These ESDs that are proposing this Frontier Network listened to your message from last session, Chair, and said, let's do some innovative things. Let's try and consolidate. They have a very unique situation because there's huge distances out there. They're trying to provide services to a lot of young people. The largest ESD in the area, Umatilla County Morrow ESD, indicated to me that they did not want to consolidate with these folks because of the distances that are involved. From Pendleton to Enterprise, for instance, is 120 miles over Mountain Pass. So these local ESDs are able to provide the services. They listened to your message from last session saying, okay, let's find some innovative ways to consolidate some of these expenses so we have more money to provide services for more children. So with that, I'll let some of the experts tell you exactly what's going on here. But I think they did a very good job in coming together and figuring out this virtual administration so they can consolidate them. School boards, State Department of Education only has to go to one group now for three. And so it just looks to me like a win-win situation for everything. And I know there's some opposition from the larger ESDs. But just keep in mind that these smaller ESDs have some pretty unique characteristics, and they're taking care of business themselves. And put some trust in that at the local level with these folks that are trying to solve their problems in their own communities.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. And this does change the formula, so this bill will have to go to finance and revenue. For that committee to make this decision,
One thing on formulas, you know, there's a lot of contracts that are not under the formulas.
Right.
So, I mean, the formulas are, formula isn't the golden grail because there's lots of other issues that are involved.
All right.
Thank you very much. And
any questions from the committee? Okay, thank you.
Getting out of here. Yeah.
We appreciate it. All right. I'd like to call three people up at once. Mr. Myers, do you have anybody that came with you? There's only people signed up in favor of the bill. Did you come with anyone in particular? I'm just going to call up some folks. Okay. So Rob Myers, Edward Jensen, and Newell Cleaver. Come on up. Rob? You're up here, too. If you're not friends, you will be. Okay. So, Rob, I'd like you to start, since you've come to my office several times on this bill.
Senator, thank you. For the record, my name is Rob Myers. I live in Condon. And I want to tell you first that we very much appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 609, specifically 609-3. We introduced both the -1s and the -3s, and we testify today in support of the -3s.
Do the -3s incorporate your -1s, or
yes.
You just don't even want to consider the -1 anymore?
Well, we would prefer the -3s primarily because it does incorporate the $1 million floor for Lake and Harney ESDs, which we originally
okay.
discussed with them. So
right.
We would prefer those.
Okay.
I won't take up very much of your time this morning because I believe that the folks who are with me have more important things to say than I do. Plus, I've been able to discuss this with the chair and with Senator Cruz before, and I apologize to Senator Morse and Senator Metzger given the timing of the bill coming out of Legislative Council and the amendments we had to entertain. I wasn't able to talk with you folks. Outside the protocol, it required that I talk with Senator Walker first. So, anyway, I'm going to let these fellows go ahead and explain exactly why it is that we're doing what we're doing. It's a unique opportunity that exists among these three Frontier Rural ESDs due to the fact that they are the only three ESDs in the state that actually generate more tax revenues than they get from the state school fund. It's a unique opportunity to be able to provide a slightly better educational experience for several thousand Frontier Rural students than would otherwise be available to them. And as much as anything else, there is, for all intents and purposes, no practical, perceptible negative impact on any other K-12 student in the state of Oregon by the approval of this legislation. I also want to say that for the last 8 years, since 1999, we came down here, and I think several of you remember the Frontier Learning Network. The Frontier Learning Network was a distance learning program that we were successful in enabling through the legislative action, almost overwhelmingly approved in the House and unanimous in the Senate. We had a meeting this year and decided that the monies that had previously been allocated for the Frontier Learning Network, which was originally $950,000 per biennium, and recently has dropped to $500,000 considering the impacts of budget shortfalls in the past. Those of us at North Central ESD, including Superintendent Lanny and the board, agreed that these monies that were originally intended to the Frontier Learning Network would be better spent on behalf of more kids by utilizing them in this process as an offset to whatever impact might have on the state school fund. So you can really count that there's $500,000 that we agreed would be better spent on behalf, as I said, of more students with relation to overall impact than it would be just through the Frontier Learning Network. So with that, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them, but I think that, as I said, these folks have a story to tell that you haven't heard yet.
Okay, well, let's hear from the other two before we open up for questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. You, sir, who wants to go next?
Madam Chair, my name is Edward Jensen, and I am the Wallawa ESD Superintendent. As Rob Myers already stated, five out of the last six legislative sessions, there have been attempts to consolidate or remove the small ESDs as entities and combine us with others. One of the problems that we faced in the last legislative session was that we did not have the capacity to do the things that ODE wanted us to do, and also that there were too many ESDs for the State Department of Education to work with. We listened to that argument, and of course we also countered that argument with the fact of local control and the cost it would take, that you wouldn't have any savings there. But we also came back with saying we can't continue to every legislative session or every other legislative session to come down here and continue to waste our time trying to beat back perceptions about our capacity. So the one way we can solve that is to form a virtual merger where the state would see basically one report or one point of information to be gathered and to be given to the State Department of Education or anybody else for that matter that would encompass three local ESDs who would still retain their their local autonomy to make decisions in their vast areas with small schools. One of the problems that we've always had is you have 11,000 square miles in these three ESDs. And to be able to control those from some other place, as has already been pointed out to you by Senator Nelson, Umatilla-Morrow ESD ran a study about what happens if they were if we consolidate with them. And it was actually, according to George Murdoch, it was going to cost them $700,000 after the funding for them to do this with us. We feel that if we can do this, not only will we continue to be able to provide quality service to our schools, but we also solve a problem that seems to be a reoccurring one, and that is that the state would see basically one ESD instead of three. Even though the three would still have their local autonomy, one ESD would be responsible to the state for all of the reports. One of the other items that I would like to bring up to the committee, if I may, is that I sit on the Quality Education Commission. And the commission has developed a model of schools that provides the best possible chance for our schools to meet the needs of almost every student. And I believe this committee has been addressed by members of the Quality Education Commission. I want to make it very clear, sitting on that committee, and I agree with everything that they said, the practicality of getting that done in the small schools in Eastern Oregon is not going to happen. There isn't the student population, and there isn't the resources for each school to go out and each have a own counselor, full-time counselor, have full-time librarians, and all the other things that the Quality Ed asks for. However, it is possible with the ESDs to be working hand-in-hand with them that model could be approached. And so consequently, we see this bill as also a way for us to be able to start reaching towards meeting the model as specified by the Quality Education Commission and developed as in the report. One other item that we need to be that I would like to bring up to the committee here is that we truly understand that these problems of distance, small class sizes, inability to hire teachers or unavailable teachers is our problem. And it's a problem that we have to solve locally. But what we would like to have is to have the one tool that we need to be able to do that, and that is the resources and the aggregation of those resources throughout the three ESDs to be able to approach and try to solve those problems. We're never going to come down to you and say, well, we've got to have a counselor. What are you going to do about it? I mean, that's unfair. It's our problem. We have to deal with it. What I'm asking for is the tool, the one tool that we can't get ourselves, and that is that be able to aggregate the resources needed to do that. I would, again, like to thank the commission for committee.
We'll be anything you want us to be this morning.
The committee for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Thank you for coming all the way over here. It's a bit of a drive.
It is a bit of a drive.
Beautiful country out there. When people talk about God's country, you got it out there in Wallowa County. Thank you. You are?
I am Newell Cleaver. Thank you,
Great.
Chair Walker. For
Mr. Cleaver, I get to say that.
You do. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
I'm very happy to be here, and I do appreciate the committee taking the time to hear our statements today. My name is Newell Cleaver, and I'm a superintendent of schools in John Day, Oregon, and I've been in Eastern Oregon education business since 1972, mostly as a superintendent. I've worked during those years with most of the ESDs in Eastern Oregon, and as a superintendent and one who actually gets in the classroom and evaluates teachers and gets to work with kids, I have for many years encouraged the ESDs to be as creative as possible in terms of how they do their business so that the maximum number of dollars that are spent can actually be spent in the classroom. Over the years, that has met with some resistance. But this Senate Bill 609-3 is a refreshing movement on the part of three ESDs and the leadership in those ESDs to recognize that this proactive step is a way of trying to get more dollars into the classroom and manage those dollars as efficiently as possible. When we tell our stories about what we deal with on a daily basis, obviously one of the first things that we have to talk about is distance. In my school district, I run 1,000 miles a day on my buses just to pick up our students. That's kind of hard to comprehend by some people. I have a school 27 miles south of John Day that is a great little school, Seneca. In fact, there's a picture out here in the foyer of the cattle drive, and that's not far from our school in Seneca. The ESDs have provided some great service for our schools and our kids. And I used to think that if we just dissolved the ESDs and took all that money and put it into the school district, that might solve some of our problems. I don't believe that anymore. The ESDs provide services in our district. For example, the technology department. We actually do have 21st century technology. We actually can communicate and provide classes online and do those things, and that's a service through resolution that the ESDs provide. By combining the three ESDs, each of these ESDs have areas that they can do better than another ESD, but as a combination can even provide those services to other ESDs that are currently not providing them. Special ed is another area that we simply do not have the resources, the number of people to staff the special ed departments, but through a combination of these three ESDs, we will leverage that. We will have a greater opportunity to provide special ed services in a quality manner. I encourage this committee to seriously consider 609-3. I believe it's the right thing to do for our kids in Eastern Oregon, and I believe that one of the arguments that we hear is, well, what is it going to do to the rest of the kids in Oregon? Well, it's going to have no negative effect, as far as I know, and I'm sure the committee will want to ask more questions about that. But I do encourage you to consider it and support it, and recognize that this is a volunteer effort on the part of these ESDs to finally, I don't like to use the word consolidate, but certainly to pool resources.
That's sort of a tender word.
Sort of a touchy word, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I think all of us have been in the legislature long enough to figure that one out.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions from the committee for these fine gentlemen?
He's the consolidation cleaver.
I appreciate you coming all the way over and that you're thinking outside the box, which was another phrase we used a couple of years ago, but it's still an important one, and I appreciate that. We do have someone to testify who doesn't quite think this is going to get us what you need, but we'll hear about that pretty soon. So thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left. I have three people remaining to testify. Anthony Lanny and Randall Anderson. You both came from more than 100 miles. Come on up. And then we'll finish up with Ozzie Rose, and we'll have Ozzie come up last because he doesn't support this bill, I don't think.
I say we vote, Madam Chair, just based on the cumulative miles that the witnesses had to travel.
All right. Okay. Would you like to start, sir?
Yes. My name is Anthony Lanny. I'm the superintendent of both the North Central Education Service District and the Grant Education Service District. And, of course, I'm in favor of this. Edward Denton and I have been working on this for quite a while. We have engaged in some cooperative efforts in the past and have gained from those. We've been engaged in a we consolidated curriculum people and received a grant from the State Education Department and serve much of Eastern Oregon on the new high school requirements. That was sort of the impetus to move forward and look at other ways that we could combine and add capacity with the same staff that we now have, so that we are augmenting and supplementing each other rather than hiring new people to do our jobs. I think it's innovative. The downside is very, very small. I don't see any large downside. I did want to bring just a couple of things to your attention that you might not be aware of. You heard Superintendent Cleaver talk about 1,000-mile buses. He's very polite. What he didn't explain was that only 20% of the roads in Grant County are paved, 70% are gravel, and 10% are dirt. Now, I got in trouble with the road department because I said that they had 80% of the roads were dirt, and I was taken back and explained that 70% were gravel, only 10% were dirt.
And that is a distinction with a difference, I think, for the department.
If you're in Eastern Oregon and you talk to the roadmaster and you say dirt road, you better know what you're talking about because they will be upset. They know the difference between gravel and dirt.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could you explain this to Senator Morris? He doesn't really understand the difference.
He's a gravel man, you see.
Well, he would understand this. The other thing that has possibly been left out, just so that you understand, at this, and I mean that positively, at this juncture, with the loss of timber money, these counties are losing tremendous amounts of resources. And this is a way that we can use moderate resources and accomplish a positive outcome. So, yes, I'm in favor of it. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those questions.
All right. Thank you. Let's hear from Mr. Anderson first, and then we'll... Senator Morris, can you hold your question?
No, certainly.
Okay.
Yes, certainly.
Great. I'll get you
Madam
first.
Chairman, I'm Randall Anderson. I've served on the school board at Enterprise since about 1991. I come here to support this bill. The success of the ESD is greatly related to the success of our schools. We suffer from falling enrollment, lack of we have trouble recruiting teachers and retaining teachers. We rely on the ESD to provide the services that we as an individual school cannot do. They provide all of our special education services. They provide speech-language specialists. They do our business office services. They prepare the payroll, psychological testing. And as more requirements come down the road, graduation requirements, we're going to rely on them to provide the higher-level math and science education, things that we cannot as an individual school provide for our students. So the success of the ESDs is very important to the success of the individual constituent schools. And so based on that, I would urge your support for this bill.
Okay, great. Senator Morris has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you financially modeled this concept in a pro forma that would look at existing and what it would actually look like reduced to numbers?
We know. My answer is no, although we've discussed it. We haven't run it through a traditional model. We do not believe that it will take very minor additional staff to accomplish this. Maybe some secretarial help in terms of providing the combination of the reports to send to ODE, because the reports will have to be combined. But that would be a minor amount given the gain that will occur from the efforts of cooperation.
But just as a follow-up, Madam Chair, I think it would be helpful for the legislature to understand more specifically how this would be actually modeled.
We can have that for you.
That's, Senator, that's partly why this is going to finance and revenue, because they got to figure this out.
We've already discussed having a flow chart and a model for the revenue committee.
Okay. Terrific. Any other questions from the committee? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. Thank you for your service.
We appreciate it. Thank you, Senator Walker and the other senators.
Yeah, and I expect we'll probably move this bill this morning to Finance and Revenue, and you'll be coming back again. Ozzie Rose, you want to come up and give us a little comment here?
Could you ask this witness, Madam Chair, how far he came?
He came clear from the back of the room.
Well, he came late, so he didn't even sign in. I had to sign him in myself, Mr. Rose. We start this committee at 8:15, but starting Thursday, it's 8 a.m. So we'll see you then.
And she said if you're late again, she's going to start at 7:45. So, Ozzie,
exactly
be on
right.
time, damn it.
All right, with all of that, would you please state your name for the record so the people in TV land know who we're beating up on this morning?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose. I reside at 1323 Jordan Drive in Salem, and I represent the Oregon Association of ESDs. And as to where I'm from, where I came from, I've come full circle from my retirement. I'm now back where I testify in with school districts on both sides of what I say, which is how I fit my life. If you're going to move the bill down to revenue, I think it is a prior referral. We would encourage you to move it down there without recommendation. We have two issues with the bill. First of all, the policy question of using the intergovernmental agreement to put the three together, that doesn't need legislation. If they think that's a good idea, they have the authority to do that. The second issue is the funding issue is really a change in the formula. And the money that's available by making the change is available because of the way the formula is set up from what we used to do. The three SDs that are involved in this proposal all have tax rates. One's $3.70, one's $2, and one's $3.70. The other 17 ESDs have tax rates of less than a dollar, and 11 of them have tax rates of less than 50 cents. On the other side of the coin, the districts represented in the three ESDs all have tax rates below the statewide average for school districts, and in two of the ESDs, they are considerably lower. And it's this difference that has allowed the ESD money to be levied and then counted as local revenue for the local districts in the general distribution formula. And what the proposal is don't call that local revenue. Then the state will have to backfill the local districts, and the ESDs pick up the difference. And, yes, it's not a lot of money. But the 15 districts that are involved here range in size from 27 kids to 985 kids. And their revenue ranges from $5,570 to $7,048. 97 of our school districts fit in that same range. Half of our school districts are like these districts in terms of size and the revenues they have. None of the small districts have enough revenue to do everything we want them to do. This ought to be addressed, though, in the larger picture of the formula. There are 6 to 10 bills in the revenue committee right now messing with or talking about changing the formula. This ought to be part of that discussion and looked at as a total picture, and we encourage you to send the bill down there without recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thanks for being here.
I'm going to be on time next time.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 609 and open a work session on Senate Bill 609. Mr. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 609 to the Committee on Finance and Revenue without recommendation and attach to the bill for committee consideration the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments.
Okay, let's see if I can repeat that one. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 609 without recommendation to the Committee on Finance and Revenue and attach Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments without adopting them, just attach them and send them along with the bill for consideration. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Can I have some discussion on that from the committee?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Why don't you speak to your motion?
I will. And you know, being fully supportive of what is being attempted here, but, Madam Chair, what we have heard several times now from the folks is, A, this has no impact on formula. B, this has impact on formula. And in my considered opinion, what is needed at this point is for Paul Warner and his good staff to make the runs to make that determination. And because it's important that we do that, and it just, Madam Chair, didn't make sense for us to be taking on. When you throw Paul Warner into the mix, that says revenue, and so I thought the runs should be done and should be considered in the appropriate committee. This had a subsequent referral, so I think it's appropriate that that discussion and that decision be made there.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. I appreciate that motion and that thoughtfulness. Colleagues, we met with all the parties a couple of times, and it became clear this wasn't something we could solve in the policy committee, and I do appreciate that they are thinking very creatively in the frontier districts about how to deliver services and save money, because Senator Cruz and I last session were very much interested in doing that and created some new ways for ESDs to operate. So that seems to be the best idea that we can have this morning, unless anyone has another idea or any comment?
Well,
question?
Just a comment, Madam Chair.
Sure.
First of all, I'm very empathetic to this bill, and I think our witnesses very articulately testified to the some of the challenges presented in the frontier districts. I mean, these are districts that makes, you know, Senator Cruz's Douglas County look urban, and it's they face real challenges and unique difficulties. They spent a great deal of time out in your fair country, so I appreciate not only your efforts for what you do, but where you do it. I very much understand what you're saying. So, and thank you for traveling again, as always, great distances for what you passionately believe in. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Okay.
Madam Chair, just to say that the motion without recommendation is due to the fact that there's unresolved issues, not due to lack of support.
Thank you for clarifying that, and I couldn't agree with you more. All right. Ms. Gravel, will you take the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Westland?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz? Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 609 is on its way to revenue. Gentlemen, we'll see you back here in another committee. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 609. All right. We're about 5 minutes behind, but it looks like we're going to make that up because someone else forgot to set their alarm clock this morning. We won't be hearing Senate Bill 755 today. I think only Ozzie Rose had signed up to testify. Mr. Rose, you're around the building. You don't mind having that rescheduled, do you? that will be another week down the road. We tried to schedule all the ESD bills on the same day, and someone that needed to be here didn't notice that. So we won't go for that. We will go right into Senate Bill. Wait a minute. Is he here?
He is. Being
on his way. Okay. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 800. Ms. Richardson, tell us what that bill is all about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 800 requires school districts and education service districts to make annual full financial reports public. It withholds the state school fund allocation from districts that fail to disclose the report upon petition or request. It allows school districts or education service district resident to initiate an independently funded audit of school district or education service district expenditures.
Okay, and this is a bill brought to us by Senator Whitsitt.
He is on his way from another hearing.
He should be here in a moment. And then we only have Jim Green and Chuck Bennett to testify, and you guys can wait, if you would, please. We'll stand at ease until Senator Whitsitt arrives.
And then just so you know, the division of honor.
Senator Whitsitt has arrived. If you want to come forward, sir, and announce your presence and tell us what you want us to do with this bill.
Good morning, Chair Walker. My name is Senator Doug Whitsett. I represent District 28, members of the committee. I want to thank you for accommodating my schedule this morning. Senate Bill 800 represents a much-needed fix to Oregon's public records law. A short anecdote regarding what happened in Klamath County might be instructive. Several years ago, statements were made by several district patrons alleging malfeasance and misappropriation of funds by the Klamath County School District Administration. In response to those allegations, the administration initiated an investigation. The administration hired a lawyer, who in turn hired an accountant and an investigator. The investigator and the accountant plied their trade and reported back to the attorney. The attorney reported to the district administration. And the administration reported to the district patrons that there was no malfeasance and no misappropriation of funds. There was no harm, no foul. When the district patrons requested the report, the administration said no and claimed attorney-client privilege. And the courts upheld the attorney-client privilege in this matter. Senate Bill 671 is addressing that attorney-client privilege use in judiciary. The fact is that neither the report nor the financial ledgers of the district investigation have ever been fully disclosed to the public. Each school district and ESD undergoes a financial opinion audit each year by a qualified private CPA of the district's choice. The district is then required to submit that audit to the Secretary of State, where it is put online for public viewing. As I understand it, so long as the numbers match up, the audit is pretty much reported out as clean. The audit's management discussion and analysis provides an accountant's discussion of the findings of that audit. I want to actually have a copy of the Klamath County audit here. And I just wanted to read a section with your leave. Internal control over financial reporting. In planning and performing our audit, we consider Klamath County School District's internal control over financial reporting in order to determine our auditing procedures for the purpose of expressing our opinions on the financial statements and not to provide an opinion on the internal control over financial reporting. And it goes on to continue disclaiming any ownership of the internal control of the district. We note no matters involving the internal control over financial reporting and its operation that we consider to be material weaknesses occurred, is your final report. Basically, the auditor has no opinion on the veracity of the internal controls over which the district auditing is based. Currently, there is no way for district patrons to obtain an investigation and discussion of the suitability of the business practices of their school district. Senate Bill 47, if passed, would direct the Department of Education to establish a system of auditing business practices of school districts and education service districts. However, the bill specifies that only districts that volunteer for the audit of their business practices will be audited by the Secretary of State. In my mind, the voluntary business practices audit is oxymoronic at best. I really do not envision a district with known misappropriations buried in their books or with known business practice failures asking to be audited. This bill will provide district patrons a method to discover the actual financial workings and business practices of their school district. A district patron or group of patrons may force a business practices or forensic audit of their district by petitioning the Department of Education so long as the patrons pay for the private audit. It is my understanding that discovery of misappropriations or malfeasance by an audit is usually the result of a tip or of inside information. What Senate Bill 800 will do is allow an independent auditor paid by district patrons to start with the district's public audit and probe into specific business practices or forensic issues identified by district patrons. This bill could only improve the transparency of school district finances. District patrons will be assured that their tax dollars are being well spent. School districts will be assured that they are using best business practices, and there are no losers, Madam Chair, unless there's something to be hidden. Thank you.
Well, that's a good line. Any questions from the committee? I actually have one, Senator Whitson. I agreed to give you this hearing because I wanted to hear what your issue was beyond what we dealt with in judiciary. You know that we had a bill in judiciary we just passed out last week. I can't remember the bill.
Senate Bill 671.
671, that's right. Thank you. So how is this bill different from what we did?
671 deals with attorney-client privilege. This bill deals with transparency in the audit.
Okay.
It allows the district patrons to request and petition for an audit paid by that patron or those patrons to probe into the finances of the district, and specifically to look for things that someone may have been tipped off to. I mean, the current law requires an opinion audit of the school district annually.
Okay.
But that opinion audit, as I pointed out in my testimony, is limited by having no opinion over the internal controls on which it's based.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator, for bringing this issue forward. I'm wondering if we could solve the problem a little differently in that if you change the auditing standards. It's amazing to me that you'd have an opinion, a certified opinion, without review of internal controls.
I was somewhat amazed as well, Senator.
Yes, and typically audits have management letters, and those letters review the internal control, anything with respect to the financial records of the organization. And they make recommendations with respect to what is short and what needs attention. And I'm wondering if this issue of what's expected in an audit needs to be reviewed, and then make that, just a matter of course, make it public. You raise an issue about, I wonder how the rest of the districts conduct their audits and disclose those results and management letters to the public.
Mm-hmm. I do not know this to be true, but the passage that I read in part two appears to be boilerplate language for that district audit. I would suspect that would be the case.
I think I'll ask Mr. Hibner from the audits division to come up and answer a couple questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Whitson. I appreciate you coming down from committee.
Thank you.
So I'll call up the audits division right now, and then I'll get to the other guys in the back, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Hibner, did you hear all of that testimony?
Yes, I did. Yes,
okay,
I did.
So maybe you could talk to us a little bit about and respond to Senator Morse's question after you introduce yourself and your guests.
Yeah, certainly. Chair Walker, committee members, Chuck Hibner, Director of the Audits Division. With me today is Phil Hopkins. He is our audit manager over our municipal audit program. So I will probably defer to him in large part on answering these questions, because he deals with these audit reports on a daily basis and has for quite some time.
Okay.
The question, as I understood it, is primarily what's the role of the internal control reviews and what sort of opinion or lack of are we expressing in a standard audit report? And Phil, do you want to answer that question a little bit?
For the record, my name is Phil Hopkins. I'm an audit manager with the Secretary of State Audits Division. Chair Walker, Senator Morris, I believe you brought up a very good point. The audits that are performed annually, that are required to be performed, are opinion engagements on the financial statements as a whole. Okay, and also the varying opinion units. So, as previous testimony pointed out, it is about the numbers, okay? So I think that's a fair statement to state. However, there are two sets of standards out there. There's what's called generally accepted auditing standards, and then there is what's called the Yellow Book standards, called generally accepted government auditing standards. And if an audit is performed under those standards, there is a report on internal control and tests of compliance. And in that report, what happens is the auditor comes out and he says, you know, we have looked at internal control. We don't issue an opinion on internal control like we do on the numbers. Nevertheless, we do tests of internal control so that we can plan what kind of testing we're going to do. I mean, we look at the policies and procedures. We see how transactions are recorded. We see if, you know, who's in place and who's doing what, who's reconciling the bank accounts. That's all this big picture of internal control. So we do that in order to plan what additional tests we're going to do. Now, if they find that there's some significant wrong deficiencies, shall we say, in those internal controls while they're doing the audit, they will put that in this so-called boilerplate report as a reportable condition, and they will cite it. However, most of the time, and once in a while you will see that, but most of the time, yeah, there are issues out there. It could be anything from like, Mr. School District, you don't reconcile your bank accounts except once a year, or you only have one person who's receiving all the money and dispersing it and recording all the books and stuff like that. Those items, what they do is the auditor looks at that when they're doing their audit and they say, okay, there's some weaknesses here and we're going to adjust our tests accordingly. It doesn't mean that the numbers are incorrect. It just means that there's some weaknesses here and we're going to have to adjust our testing. And what they will do, as Senator Morris pointed out, that will then end up in a management letter to the district, making the recommendations for improvement, saying these are weaknesses and this is what we want to do. Furthermore, if there is a management letter issued, that is stated in that internal control report. So, for instance, like you read part of that, it said, well, you know, there was no reportable condition. Well, if the management letter was issued, it's stated in there, and it's available. And so people are notified to that respect. But they don't, as you say, they don't specifically issue an opinion. They don't say internal controls are, you know, fairly stated or they're without blemish or they have no weaknesses. They just use it as a springboard for conducting the audit.
Is your question answered?
Well, thank you for directing it back to me. What happens in school districts and ESDs in terms of making public the audits and management letters? Is it standard practice? Is there any prohibition? Is there any requirement that that become public?
Senator Walker, Chair Morris, in our minimum standards that we require, which is the minimum standards for audits of Oregon municipal corporations, we require the auditor to, in the back section of the report, it's called auditor's comments and disclosures, we require them to state in that report whether or not a management letter was issued. And in doing so, that makes it available to us because, to be honest with you, if I get any calls from citizens or something like they say, you know, something went wrong, what I do is I'll go to the audit report. The auditor said there was a management letter issued. Mm-hmm. Then I will request copies of that. So, yeah, should that be issued or should be it available? Yes.
But it is not now required by law?
Senator Walker, Chair Morris, I'm sorry, what is it not?
Is it required by law to make public?
Senator Morris, I would think that's probably a better question to be asked by the Board of Accountancy, who licenses municipal auditors or and all CPAs out there, and can perhaps address that more, well, better.
Okay. Senator Cruz has a question.
Yeah, a couple, Madam Chair. Thank you. I guess I'm wondering, when you're looking at internal controls, what, and you see things that are wrong, what level of wrong do you have to see before it creates a management letter? And is there a responsibility to respond once the letter has been sent?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, the responsibility, there is some judgment, all right? It's basically, it is in the audit stand, there is some auditor judgment. But If you have some findings, if you have some concerns, the auditor should either document it in the working papers and state that they communicated that information to the entity. So, for instance, like, let's take the issue they didn't reconcile their bank accounts every month, you know, and so they did it every 2 or 3 months. And I said, well, you know, that's not a serious thing, but I'm going to tell them that this is what we found and you should do a better job, you know, to stay on top of this stuff. So I may not put that in the management letter, but I'm going to tell you about it, and then I document it because this is something that I found in my testing. So there is some judgment in there, but when it gets to more serious matters, like let's take that same kind of issue, but let's say that there's a lot of outstanding items and we couldn't identify it. We couldn't reconcile the bank accounts and stuff like that. Well, then that could be serious, especially if there's large amounts, and that you would want to put into a management letter, you know, something, because it's a red flag, you know. And when we get into the stands, we kind of talk about serious or significant deficiencies, you know, and so there is some judgment out there.
And if I might add to Senator Cruz, not only would they document that sort of thing in a management letter if it was significant or even, in the management letter, they would increase their testing. Anytime there is internal controls aren't quite as they expect, that affects our testing plans, and we may look at more items in order to get that assurance that particular deficiency isn't in some way affecting the numbers in a way that we don't expect. And we'd also follow up the following year on that particular deficiency, whether it's oral and documented in the working papers or a management letter, to make sure action had been taken and corrected. So there's several reasons for wanting to document that beyond just the public interest nature.
I might add, you know, the auditors need to protect themselves too, you know, and so it's only to their benefit that they put everything in writing and communicate all of this information.
Yeah, but is there a requirement? A management letter has been sent. Is there a requirement to respond to that letter? I mean, what kind of paper trail are we creating here?
Okay. Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, there is not.
Okay.
No, and of course, I'm only speaking on municipal audit law, okay, right. for the local governments. There's not a requirement for them to respond.
And is that what we're asking to have done, basically, here in Senate Bill 800, gentlemen?
My understanding, Chair...
It's just to make it public.
My understanding, Chair Walker, from my reading of the bill, is it really didn't address that particular aspect of it. It was asking more for an independently initiated audit of some function of school's expenditures. So to require a management letter to a public institution to be made public, that may take a change in the law. Maybe something that can be done of its own volition. The reports certainly are made public, the overall reports, and we post them on our website.
Well, sure, I download them all the time when I'm interested in a particular agency.
Yeah, I think you're probably a number of our web hits on our website. But as far as the management letter posting, it's a little different element. It's not, you know, anything that's seriously important, you know, like an opinion or serious findings of those natures are in the report. Of lesser significance goes in a management letter that's communicated with the auditee without a requirement to respond. And as far as the disclosure requirements under that, it may be more optional than anything else. I really don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, it's just quite simply because we're looking for accountability here, and paper trails are important. So the correspondence, so it's going back and forth. And I would just think if a letter was sent identifying deficiencies and there's no requirement to respond, then they could still be right at the same place the next time the audit's performed, and you can end up with the same letter. But, I mean, clearly you'd be looking at more things, but that isn't necessarily solving the problem. So,
Senator Walker, Chair Cruz, I might want to add one other thing about this municipal audit law. Whenever I do a review of one of their audit reports, which is on a sample basis, the auditor is required to put comments and disclosures in the back of the report. If there are any violations of law, their funds aren't collateralized, or they don't exceed their debt limitations, or they have illegal investment, or most likely there's some kind of violations of budget process, whenever that happens, I write to the entity And if it's a city or a county, they are required by law to pass a resolution to make corrections, deal with that, and send a response back to the Secretary of State. If it is something other than a city or a county, I write to them, but I can only say I'm requesting, you know, or the way I put it is normally what resolutions are you intending to pass to make these corrections? Okay. If it has something to do, if it was like an internal control thing, and it just said, well, they don't have enough staff, I don't usually write on that. But if it's some kind of a violation, something where they can make some kind of correction, and I've reviewed that report, I will. I mean, it's part of our responsibility. We will write them when we ask for a response to that. But we don't do it for the fact that a management letter was issued. So.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Audits always seem to generate lots of conversation in this committee.
Good thing we're big talkers. Huh?
Yeah. All right. We've got about 5 minutes left allocated for this hearing. Jim Green and Chuck Bennett, you want to come up and be the dynamic duo today? You're checkmarked against.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association, did sign up in opposition to the bill, and I want to make one thing real clear right off the top. The audit, the audit reports, the management letter, anything that is done through the audit provision of ORS Chapter 297, which is our municipal financial audit law in this state, is a public record. It is not exempt from disclosure. Matter of fact, with school districts and education service districts, the auditor has to file that with the Secretary of State's office. I think Mr. Hopkins explained that to you. In addition, in school districts, we have to file that with the Department of Education. And if we don't have it to their desk by, I think it's November 30th, if I'm remembering correctly, and somebody from the Department of Ed may be able to correct me, we don't get our state school fund payment. Mm-hmm. There is a hammer at the Department of Education. So those audits, those letters, everything that's done with regard to an audit of a school district and its funds, or a management letter that may have indications about problems going on with internal controls, are public records. They are not exempt from disclosure. They must disclose those. The concerns that we have with the bill, and I think Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt explained some of the issues that have gone on down in Klamath County, and you know, sitting on the Senate Judiciary Committee, we dealt with that issue of what's attorney-client privilege and what's not now. That was a very well orchestrated and negotiated bill that the chair, Senator Burdick, did with regard to local government lawyers and the bar and everybody concerned, including cities, counties, and school districts. I think we've got a good balance there that so from here on out, after that bill becomes law, and we do support that bill as it's currently written and will be heading to the Senate floor, we won't have reports made that the public at least won't get a condensed version of the report. Because if you take a look at 671, what it says is, municipal government, if you got a report from your attorney, there's still attorney-client privilege there, but you must make available a condensed version of that. That'll be reviewed by the AG, the district attorney, or a court to determine whether that's the accurate version of that report. If it's not, it's sent back and say, redo that. But in no way do you waive your attorney-client privilege, which I think was the main issue. If you take a look at Senate Bill 800, we already do audits. The problem that we have with the bill is it says that the patrons or the group of folks will pay for the full cost. Well, they pay the auditor's cost. They don't pay the school district's cost because mm-hmm. you don't just turn your records over to an auditor. I think if you asked an auditor and the standards that are set out in 279 for an auditor, you don't just turn your records over. They're there for 2 or 3 days going through the records, and they have questions of the folks. And that takes time and effort away from the main duties of those folks in the school district. I think one of the things that was brought forward by Mr. Hopkins, and we'd be supportive of, if there's a management letter and they find that there's internal control problems, why shouldn't we have the same requirement that cities and counties do, which is to respond to that? Respond both to the Secretary of State's office and to the Department of Education, because they're both getting our audit. If that's something this committee and Senator Whitsitt wants to go for, we'll support that. I think that's probably prudent. I think that's probably good accountability. I think that's also feedback to the public on these have been found. Let's get our hands around it. But I don't think Senate Bill 800 is the answer that we're looking for. We already do audits. We've taken care of the attorney-client privilege, or it's working its way through the process here in the building. But if there's an accountability issue, let's deal with that so that you can make, and I believe it's found in 297, if I remember the law correctly, 466 and 297, with regard to cities and counties, I think there is a requirement that they respond to those management letters. Let's put that requirement on school districts and education service districts so that if there are internal control issues that Mr. Hopkins talked about, that they've got to respond to it and make those documents public just like they are currently. We don't have a problem with that. We think that's probably strengthening the accountability and will strengthen the municipal financial audit laws that relates to school districts and education service districts.
And this relating clause on this bill is relating to education districts, so we can...
It's, Madam Chair, probably broad enough to drive a truck through.
I think so. I'm not sure Senator Witz understood that, but... sometimes we deliberately draft our relating clauses very broad, and sometimes we do it very narrow so nobody can monkey with it. But in this case, I think it allows us some discretion. Mr. Bennett, just wrap it up, if you would. I think we get the gist here.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I think Jim covered it as completely as possible. The main thing is that the bill... Ultimately, we don't believe changes the current state of the law, including who would be doing these independent audits. It really just imposes an additional cost on school districts, and certainly agree with Jim's proposed change. If there is a need to respond to management letters, no problem. That really makes sense. But otherwise, these are public documents. It's publicly disclosed. It's done by independent auditors. This would just add another layer of independent auditors on top of the existing independent auditors. So with 671 and the disclosure requirements, we think the thing is resolved.
And Madam Chair, I'd offer up myself, and I'll offer up Chuck, too, just because he's up here with me, to work with Senator Whitson and the committee if they want to change the law so that we have to respond to those management letters. I think that's probably good accountability, and we can work with the committee or Senator Whitson to get that done.
Well, I actually would like you to do that. I think that's a good point Senator Cruz brought up, and Senator Morse raised some issues about audits, and I really don't think we need the bill as it is, but I would like to do some more work on that. So I'll leave that in your hands. I don't need to be on another work group. Questions from the committee? Everybody's got a thumbs up. Okay, well, great. We're going to close the public hearing. Thank you, gentlemen. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 800. We're doing pretty good. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 774. Ms. Richardson, as soon as you collect yourself, what is this bill about?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 774 directs the Department of Education to establish a Kindergarten Plus program for students identified as needing extra help to learn to read. It directs the Department of Education to develop curriculum, directs the department to develop a certification program for reading tutors, requires school districts to offer the program to all kindergarten students, and requires reports to the legislature as well. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007.
Great. And I believe we have... Who's going to testify? Someone from your office, Senator Morris?
Yes, Madam Chair. Occasionally I'm reminded I'm just a gravel guy. and when I have somebody that has had a lifelong career in education, maybe that makes more sense to have my policy advisor, Ed Wright, present this bill, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to defer to someone other than the gravel guy. Thank you. Mr. Wright, if you'll just take a seat there and announce who you are and all of those good things, we'll get started.
Madam Chair, Sanders, my name is Ed Wright, and my background is a lifelong educator. I went to a college called Penn State University and worked on a PhD in curriculum and instruction with the primary goal to find out how adults learn. And at that point in time, there wasn't a great deal of research on that, so most of the time was spent on why children learn or how children learn, and to develop a thesis for that. Two of the primary tenets for that was one that one of the necessary and sufficient tenets for learning is that you have time on task. And the other one is that the time on task takes place when the student is ready to learn. And I think this bill, the Bill 774, came to our attention because it does introduce two of those tenets. One, that we have instruction available when the child is ready to learn. And two, that we have the time on task to allow the child to master learning, learning to read. And time on task is really critical because not everybody learns at the same rate. some people take more time on one thing and less time on one thing. Everyone's time varies. This kindergarten program or kindergarten plus program.
Excuse me, sir. Would you please see me afterwards? You'll be making a contribution to the Common School Fund today. Thank you. That's our first catch of the season. We appreciate it. Go ahead.
The curriculum, the Kindergarten Plus program, defines the curriculum that will help the student learn to read. It also develops a certified core of adults which can help the children on a one-to-one basis. And it gives extra time on the task of learning to read when the child is ready. And it integrates it into the kindergarten and elementary programs. On the testimony that I handed in, the curriculum will be defined by the Department of Education in consultation with the accredited Oregon Teacher Education Institutions and the Oregon Community College system. The tutors will be recruited from adults who are interested in helping, who have time to volunteer, and retired teachers. And there would be a program that is defined that will lead the teachers through, or the tutors through a training program, a certified reading tutors program, so that they have a common background and a common approach. The students would be recruited by, one, their teacher, and two, their parents, who believe that the child is behind in their reading, and to focus on learning to read. Because after the third grade, you read to learn. But first you have to learn to read. The schedule is laid out in this document, and I think it's a good bill.
All right, thank you. Do you have questions of Mr. Wright, Senator Morse, that he didn't cover? Okay, I just want to check. Because Gravel Guys actually are pretty with it. You know more than Gravel. He just doesn't like to let on. Okay, any questions from the committee?
Well,
Senator Westland?
Comment, Madam Chair. I'd just like to say that's the most articulate testimony, in fact, the most intelligible, cogent remarks ever uttered out of Senator Morris's office. I can find no better example, you know, of the expression of the English language than we just heard from the witness stand, as opposed to what we hear from the dais. So.
Well, we do a little bit of humor in this committee from time to time.
Or attempts at humor.
Attempts at humor. Thank you, Mr. Wright.
It helps in the process.
Yeah, I appreciate your testimony and hearing from you today. Somehow our sign-up sheet walked away, so we're sort of making this up as we go along. I only have Morgan Allen from the department. If anyone else was signed up for this bill, please let me know. Just somehow walked off. Probably got mixed up with someone's papers.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Allen. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Education, and I wanted to make a couple few brief remarks about the bill. I'd like to direct the committee's attention to Section 1, Subsection 3, where it states, and I'm quoting from the bill, the department shall develop curriculum for the program in consultation with our higher ed institutions, et cetera. And
yes, Mr. Wright did testify to that. And so yes. I'm sure you're about ready to tell us what that means for the
and
department.
To make this as brief as possible, because I realize that you folks are on a time crunch, the department is in the standards business. The department is not in the curriculum business. Currently, the department does not develop any of the curriculum for any core subject, math, science, reading, PE, et cetera. We also don't develop any of the curriculum for any extracurricular or volunteer programs like smart reading or other programs that might occur in our school. What we do set are the standards. We basically say these are the skills and knowledge that students shall attain by grade 4 in math, reading, et cetera, but we don't tell the local districts and the teachers or volunteers how to deliver those, how to deliver that information and get that knowledge into the children's or the students' brains. So this sort of fundamentally alters the local control relationship. The way the bill is currently written, it fundamentally alters that relationship between the department and local school districts around curriculum. And I checked with some folks at our department. The department has not been in the curriculum business since the 1970s. So I'm not here to poo-poo the bill, but I'm here to actually offer a constructive suggestion if this is a bill that the committee would like to move forward with, is that there is a bill in the House, House Bill 2763, which requires the department to contract, specifically allocates money from the general fund to the department to contract for the development of a Mandarin Chinese curriculum. So if the committee wanted to move forward with a bill like this, from the department's perspective, I know perhaps districts and administrators might have some comments about other portions of the bill, but specifically for the department, this would create a pretty significant fiscal impact on our department, at least probably $500,000 to develop the curriculum. We just don't have the people that do that in our department.
Okay.
So that's just something we wanted to bring to attention, sort of a friendly notice about the way the bill's written, and we would be happy to work with the committee or Senator Morse's office to develop amendments if it is something that you folks want to move forward.
I think, Senator Morse, I'll let you carry the candle on that.
Mm-hmm.
And
we will do so. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Allen. I appreciate your testimony. And that is all we have signed up today. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 774 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 824. We're doing pretty good, Ms. Richardson. What's going on here?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 824 allows cities and counties to establish master plans and service districts in the same manner. We have -1 and -2 amendments. Shall I
go over those?
Sure. The -1 amendments prohibits the cities from including areas outside their corporate city boundaries in a service district. It also prohibits the city from forming a service district within an existing special district that would provide the same services. The -2 amendments permit service districts established by a governing body of a city or county to elect a board either upon governing body motion or upon petition.
Okay, let's see here. We've got the proponents of the bill. I'll have Ron Papsdorf come on up, and then Andy Shaw from the League of Cities. I think I'm reading that correctly. Why don't you two come up, and then there's someone else with you. Okay, great. And we have allocated 20 minutes for this hearing because we've got another work session that's going to require some time. So, gentlemen, introduce yourselves. Mr. Papsdorf, why don't you go first?
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Papsdorf, Government Relations, City of Gresham. Justin Cutler from the City of Gresham Parks Division is joining me at the table.
Okay.
All right. I won't take a lot of time, committee members, but quickly, if I could give you, before I delve into the particulars of the bill, give you a couple of quick scenarios. Imagine you're a city in the state of Oregon. You've got significant crime and public safety issues. You've got a capped permanent property tax rate and a community that really wants to try to do something to address those public safety issues in the community. And really, you have limited tools available to raise additional revenue to increase public safety services to the community. Second scenario is your city, you've got significant urban growth boundary expansion areas. You've been growing rapidly. You've got areas that you're going to be annexing or have annexed into the city. You've engaged the community in a very extensive planning process to figure out what the development patterns, the land use patterns in that new area of your city are going to be, the infrastructure required to serve that area, and those infrastructure plans that the community has come up with in partnership with the city really result in a higher level of service demand than what is currently provided in the existing part of the city. And your city council doesn't want to subsidize that higher level of service through revenues raised within the existing part of the city to provide services to this new growth area. Now, with those two scenarios set, what Senate Bill 824 does is it extends an existing statutory authority that currently exists for counties in the state to form county service districts, and it extends that authority to cities to form service districts. I know that the bill...
I am a scary guy.
I know that the bill looks fairly lengthy, and that's because county service districts is currently referenced in several different statute areas today. So really, the bulk of the changes that are reflected in the bill really are a change from where county service district is referenced in various parts of the statute, striking the term county and referencing service districts, and a new definition for service districts then, giving that authority to both cities and counties to form service districts. What this does is provides to cities and counties a whole host of tools for raising new revenue to provide services to their citizens. Many of those, and by election of people within the proposed boundaries of a service district, can set a new permanent tax rate. So in the scenario where you've got a public safety issue you want to address, you could, in fact, pursue then a service district within the boundaries of the city and give those services a new permanent tax rate. So you're not relying on a repetitive five-year special operating levy. You're really taking some pressure off of your general fund. In the case of the city of Gresham, where we spend well over 80% of our total general fund on public safety services, would allow us to address those issues and continue to provide the other essential community services that we do to our citizens. With that, just a quick explanation on the two amendments that are before the committee for this bill. The Special Districts Association raised with me early on some concerns about the bill and its impact on special districts. And so the three concerns that were raised that we're trying to address with these amendments are, one, I wanted to make it very clear that a service district, a city could not form a service district beyond its corporate boundaries. So the dash one amendments make that crystal clear. A city could not form a city service district that extended beyond its corporate boundaries. Second issue was concern about a city service district being formed that overlapped the boundaries of an existing special district. So the dash one amendments also tell us that we can't form a city service district where the boundaries of the service district would overlap the boundaries of an existing special district that already provides that same service without the consent of that special district. The dash two amendments attempt to address the third issue that special districts raised, and the issue that special districts raised was they would prefer that a service district be governed by a separately elected governing body rather than the governing body of either the county or the city, which is allowed under current statute. It was our feeling, at least, that given that these service districts exist only within the corporate boundaries of a city, really deal with urban services that are already provided by the city, and really this is an attempt to deal with some of the financing issues, that it shouldn't be necessary to have a completely separately elected board, that ought to be a local decision. But the dash two amendments do give authority to the governing body to make that choice at the formation stage of a service district, so that in fact, if it made sense within the context of the issues that community faced, you could in fact decide to set up and establish a separately elected governing body. Also, if the electors within the boundaries of that service district in the future decided, for whatever reason, that they felt that their interests would be better served by having a separately elected body, they could in fact petition the governing body to establish and form a separately elected governing body for the service district.
Okay. Thank you. That was a great explanation.
Thank you.
So who would like to speak next?
Can we have Mr. Cutler?
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Justin Cutler, and I'm an analyst. And in reviewing some of the information and the struggles with cities and financing government services, in preparation for this bill, we looked to other states that have dealt with similar taxation structures. And we looked at the state of California, who has established similar districts, but they aren't called city service districts. One of them is a Melrose service district, which allows a city in California to establish non-contiguous boundaries to deliver park services, maintenance services, and other type of dedicated funding services. They've also established landscape and lighting districts, and these typically fund street lights, as well as park maintenance, natural area maintenance, and these are more contiguous in nature. So there are examples out there of this model being used in other jurisdictions. So we kind of took that idea and then created the city service district as a way to provide local control and local oversight within this service population and really to deliver the demanded service. Like Ron said, in Pleasant Valley and Springwater and Gresham, we have gone through extensive planning. And to be quite honest, there isn't enough permanent tax rate in order to fund the desired service level for the maintenance of parks and even the delivery of some public services such as police and fire. So this would help us meet that goal of providing the demanded services.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you must be Mr. Shaw.
Yes. Morning, Chair, members of the committee, Andy Shaw with the League of Oregon Cities. Ron, I think, did an excellent job of describing the bill and the reasons that we support it. Measures 5 and 50 have really placed cities in a straitjacket financially, and we view this as one, providing cities with another tool to raise revenues and fund local services. So currently, we are allowed to establish local improvement districts. Those are similar in notion, but they are limited in time and scope. Often, those are used to establish a sidewalk improvement, a street improvement, and the folks that benefit directly from that pay for it, but then it goes away after a period of time. The city manages that project. We support strongly the idea of the city being able to manage these districts as well, given the broad range of services and the balancing process that city governments provide to over local finances and local projects. So we support the bill and would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. I don't think we have any questions. Yes,
you Madam
have
Chair, I'm
comment?
Sorry if you will indulge me. One uh-huh. final issue. I learned late yesterday that the Sheriff's Association of the state had some questions and concerns about the bill. I did talk to John Powell this morning and address those issues. There was some concern about the role of counties if a city proposed a service district within the city, and I pointed him to existing statutes in section in 198 that already deal with the formation of districts. This bill doesn't change any of the basic parameters around how districts are currently formed in this state. There is, in fact, a role for county review if a service district would be proposed by a city under the statute. And I believe that Mr. Powell was satisfied with that address to his concern. He was here this morning. He made.
Well, he's in the back of the room, and he signed up, but he didn't checkmark any box. So he's sort of out there in space right now. We'll find out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Papsworth. Okay, I have Senator Mona Sanderson, who's arrived, and I think she'd like to address the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Senator Lori Mona Sanderson from the Greshamwood Village, Troutdale and Fairview area, and thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for hearing the bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. And I think most everything has been said. Gresham has had extreme rapid growth with the expansion of the urban growth boundary, and it's been extremely difficult, especially in the Pleasant Home, and it may be since we've had that on the books for a long time, but Springwater is the other new area. It's really difficult to expand the service delivery, and we do not want to be reducing services to existing residents and businesses. And counties currently do have statutory authority to create the service districts for a wide array of services, and it certainly would be nice for the cities to be able to have this option also. It would just be a new mechanism for cities facing significant new service territory expansions, and it's very difficult for us to raise adequate revenues for that service delivery without adversely impacting existing residents. So thank you very much for hearing it. I hope that the committee will think of this seriously and realize that it is an economic development issue, and for those areas in our area, it's extremely important. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Nope. All right, great. Mr. Powell, are you satisfied? Did you want to come up? I'll let you come up quickly, and then I need to hear from another panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Madam Chair and members of the committee, we have a bill on the Senate or on the House side that would create a sheriff's service district. I don't believe that bill is going to pass. But that was our indoctrination into trying to understand this, these sections of law, which are extremely confusing. Our concern, the way the bill was originally written, was that in the case of a special district that the sheriffs were interested in setting up, you'd go through a hearing with the county commission and that sort of thing. And the same is true, as my understanding, with the bill with these amendments, and that they've limited it to the boundaries of the city for creating these districts. I haven't had a chance to really look at the amendments, but given my talks with Ron, I think we'll be okay.
Okay. All right. All right. Thank you. I've got a panel, Burton Wiest, Kelly Ross, and Amanda Rich. And then after that, we'll hear from Deidre Conkling, and we're going to wrap this up at 10 till.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, my name is Burton Wiest, and with me is Amanda Rich and Kelly Ross, and we're all three here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. With the chair's permission, we'll just very quickly try to divide this up into three parts.
Okay.
First, I guess because of my age, I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of special districts and what a special district actually is, because I think this is critical to your understanding of this discussion. Amanda has been working with the very cooperatively with the city of Gresham, and Amanda's going to talk about the amendments that have been offered and where those discussions are. And finally, Kelly's going to talk about some of the impacts of creating a new unit of government within an existing unit of government that provides the same service. And that's a definite important issue here. First of all, the historic role of special districts has been really two things. One, to provide services in rural or unincorporated areas of Oregon, whether they're county service districts or special service districts, where there wasn't a city or a city can't provide those services. So districts are one of the three arms of local government, and cities, counties, and districts. So we're not talking today about a taxation means. We're talking about a unit of government, okay, a unit of local government that is all through the statutes and has all different kinds of requirements of government on it. The second role of districts that's come up as a result of Oregon's land use process has been districts have become regional service providers, and I think all of you in your own areas have seen that happen. There's a lot of mergers going on between districts, cities and districts, county service districts and cities and districts, as we all try to get to be more efficient under Measure 5 and Measure 50. And we're definitely sympathetic to Gresham's issues under those measures. They affect us also. But land use law has really dictated that we need to reduce the number of service providers, not increase the numbers of service provider. And you'll find in ORS 195 a whole statute that deals with the consolidation and the identifying of who's the best service provider in areas and how that service should be provided long term. So the thrust of the Boundary Commission statutes, and which still applies in the Eugene area.
Well, has not been for long. Not for long, Mr. Wiest.
Don't ask us. We like that sentiment. But at any rate, those Boundary Commission statutes are also address the idea of consolidation. I think you're all familiar with districts such as Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, serves nearly 500,000 people in three counties and a dozen cities. We're seeing this consolidation happen everywhere. So naturally, when a bill that affects converts a special district from a unit of government, okay, that's affected by all the rules that apply to cities and counties equally, that has a role in the planning process, is trying to consolidate, which is something our association supports, whether it's a city providing the service to a city or the other way around. Consolidation of cities. We have a bill in front of us now which actually takes us in a different direction, which would utilize special districts as a means to collect revenue as opposed to a unit of government to provide a service that's needed in an unincorporated area or as a regional service provider. As was mentioned, cities, you know, are facing the crunch just like we are, but cities have lots of authorities the special districts don't have, in terms of everything from sales taxes to excise taxes to passing, as we can do, local option levies to provide services that are needed beyond what can be raised in the tax rate. So they're not, as we're not, limited in tools. Also, in the statute that's being amended here, every service that local government provides is listed in that statute. This bill would allow, for the example, the creation of a planning department and the running of a planning department for one area of the city specific to that city. And it would create a tax rate that's permanent. So unlike an LID or unlike systems development charges, which cities use that build a structure and place that structure, you have a permanent tax rate, and permanently you would have the residents of one part of a city paying more taxes, property taxes, than the residents of the other side of the city. We have concerns about that. And we have concerns, again, about using the name special district, which we think is going to be very confusing to the taxpayers who are paying those rates. Senate Bill 824, therefore, is a major change in Oregon policy and about how we deal with local government. Districts are standalone, separate units of government that would now become, if this bill passed, a financing option for cities, and importantly, a financing option for small parts, potentially very small neighborhoods of cities, creating permanent tax rates that are different, differential tax rates different within the city. This bill changes 50 years of legislative history. That doesn't make this wrong. But it does, I think it should make the legislature very careful about the impacts statewide of a bill in this nature trying to solve a problem perhaps in Gresham or a couple of areas in the state. With that, if I may, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Amanda to talk about the amendments she's been working with Gresham.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Kelly. Excuse me. Talk about the application of this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Ross, also representing the special districts, and let me first apologize for my earlier electronic interruption there. I'd be honored to be the first contributor to the
We appreciate that. You can make your check out to the Common School Fund and send it to the Division of State Lands, where it will promptly...
An amount to be negotiated?
Yes, for a first offense, it's a small amount, whatever you feel justified, but after that, it goes up higher. And
understand.
Senator Cruz, what is the amount as we get closer to the end?
Oh, it gets into 60 or 70.
Yeah, because we need to make up this $30, $40, $50 million shortfall. We've got an education budget.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Your apologies accepted.
Sure. I guess I would like to speak to the second type of scenario that was described by the representative from Gresham, because in my previous life, I was the chief lobbyist for about 10 years with the Portland Home Builders Association, and was actively involved in the process to expand the urban growth boundary in Pleasant Valley, adjacent to Gresham, and the planning for that, and the initial steps in the formulation of a park SDC for that area. And I think it's important to look at what is projected to occur in that area. There's a projection of about 3,000 housing units and an additional 3,000 jobs through new commercial or industrial development in the area. Some rough back of the envelope calculations on my part was that could amount to close to $2 billion in additional assessed valuation for the area, and we're talking millions of dollars in annual property tax revenues. The reason I bring that up is because under the general statute for formation of a special service district, there's also a requirement that a case be made as to why it's necessary to form that district and what the financial considerations are under the statute for county, and if this change is made by this bill, a city service district. There isn't that type of justification required, and so the concern of the Special Districts Association is abuse of that. I'm not saying Gresham would do that, but if this is applied statewide, you could see some strong backlash by taxpayers if they're being forced to pay twice for a city service that they think they should only pay once for. So would like to raise that concern, and then I'll turn it over to Amanda.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ms. Rich. We're running close out of time.
I have 30 seconds.
Oh, you have longer than that, but keep it short.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Amanda Rich, and I'm representing the Special Districts Association. And I'd like to talk a little bit about ways that we might be able to kind of get through this issue collectively, and
We have been working with the city of Gresham and talking about amendments, and I very much appreciate Ron and the work that he's done on putting forward the amendments that you've seen today. To speak specifically to one of the amendments, it creates the ability for the citizens of this new service district to petition the governing body of either the city or the county to ask for to have their own independently elected governing board. However, the standard that's in the amendment, I think, is a little high. It says that a majority of the electors must assign that petition, and that's actually pretty high as compared to other standards in statute. Frequently what you see is 10% or 15%. A 51% standard is pretty high. So if we were to try to move forward on this, which I'm not sure that we're there yet, but we really would need to see that be lower, maybe a 10 or 15%. Other concerns about the bill that we would like to see addressed are this issue that Burton touched on very briefly. The County Service District Statute, ORS 451, has in at least one instance been interpreted to allow for the formation of a district that provides all 17 to 20 of the services that you see listed. It starts on the front page of the bill on Senate Bill 824 and goes down for a couple pages of all the different services that can be done. Well, in essence, although that's not the application that's anticipated by the city of Gresham, this would allow a city to create a separate form of government within its corporate boundaries that provides 17 to 20 different services and sets up permit tax rates for all those different services. Again, I know that that's not the application that's anticipated by the city of Gresham, but the statute, the bill as written, would allow that. And I think that we need to address that and narrow down the number of services that you could be taxing for and planning for and providing under a city within a city, essentially, which is what this bill would create. We also do have concerns, as Kelly mentioned, about the needing to have some feasibility, economic feasibility, and financial feasibility requirements. This is different. In this situation, you've got not just the formation of a new district that is going to be providing service to an area that is, as Burton mentioned, currently unserved because it's unincorporated or underserved because there's difficulty providing service for one reason or another, and you are going to create one tax rate that applies to an area, and there's going to be one form of government that governs that service. You're now going to have this overlapping situation where you have a larger form of government that is providing that service to a certain extent, and then this little smaller government within that government that is also taxing for the same service and providing the service in the same area. And I think that there should be an additional requirement to show why financially that is necessary to have an extra tax. As Kelly mentioned, the existing increased assessed value and the existing SDCs and the existing operating revenues are insufficient, and why it's necessary to tax this subset of taxpayers additionally for a service that is already being provided by the larger body.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Rich. I'm going to stop you there because we're running out of time, and this bill is screaming for a work group.
You think?
Yeah. And there's no way this committee is going to be able to solve this issue between the two entities here. We just can't do it in a committee context. So I'm going to talk to Senator Manus Anderson about putting together a work group, pulling some member off of our committee. She can find out who's more interested and has some time, but I'm not prepared to support this bill as it is today, and I'm not prepared to let it die. You've raised some significant issues, all of you have, but I think this needs a little more discussion in what we like to call a work group.
Chair Walker, we very much appreciate that because we are very sympathetic to the issues being faced by the city, and I think we can work something out.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Ross, I will let you know that your contribution to the Common School Fund is tax deductible as a charity. You do get some benefit from it. All right, thank you. Ms. Conkling, you're signed up to testify. Can you just submit your written testimony?
Sure.
There'll be a work group or something on this.
And I appreciate a work group.
All right, thank you. I just want to note for the record, Ms. Conkling was here to testify on behalf of the Lincoln County Library District, and she has written testimony. So.
Okay.
She will provide that to the committee. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 824 and open a work session on Senate Bill 621. Ms. Richardson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 621 applies to teacher administrator licensing statutes to charter schools, exempts existing charter schools, or removes the requirement for charter schools to offer online courses to have at least 50% of students reside in the charter school district, requires at least 80% of charter school students to reside in the district in which the charter school is located. It limits the numbers of students enrolled in charter schools to 10% of the total number enrolled in all public schools in a district. Declares an emergency would take effect July 1st, 2007. This should all ring a bell. We heard this on March 22nd. We have dash ones and dash twos. I suspect dash twos are going to be germane. Should I
Yes, please. The dash twos pretty significantly changed the bill.
The dash twos are gotten stuff. They raise the charter school teaching administrative licensing requirement from 50%, which it is currently, to 75%. The requirement applies to new charter schools and to existing charter schools when they renew their charter. It applies the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission standards of fitness and the power to discipline or suspend to registered charter school teachers. It applies those registrations and standards prospectively. Declares an emergency and will take effect July 1st, 2007.
Thank you. And I have three folks I need to testify to these amendments, and then I'll have some invited testimony. Lori Wimmer-Whalen, Cindy Hunt from Legislative Council, and Randy Harnish, are you here from the department? Can you come on up? I authorize Ms. Wimmer-Whalen to obtain these amendments, and I'd like her to talk about them, but Ms. Hunt, there was a piece in there that I didn't know where that came from, and since we got these late yesterday, I didn't have time to talk to you about them. So my colleagues, my question of Ms. Hunt was about this. Let me find the page. On page 9 of the dash 2 amendment, in section 8, I didn't understand what was being put in there.
Chair Walker, fellow committee members, what the amendments are doing is they're gutting and stuffing the bill.
Right.
And one of the pieces that the amendments are doing is applying the hearings process that the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission does for school districts to charter school registrations. And so when the amendments came in, they properly wanted to amend 342.177, which is Section 8, to include charter school registrations in that hearing process. And you'll see on the next page some other amendments to that section, adding in registration, mm-hmm. which is public charter school teachers. Well, in examining the statute, there was another place in here that originally just talked about a district that employs a person, and that's in the lines that Senator Walker pointed out in subsection 1. So originally, that section talked about a district that employs a person, and it talks about students attending school in the district may not attend any hearing except as witnesses. Well, sometimes charter schools employ people. They're not all the charter school registrants are not employed by a district. So it was necessary to treat the students that were at charter schools the same way as students that are at regular schools. And so the second line was added in there to replicate it but change it for charter school employees. And you see there are students attending a public charter school that employs the person, may not attend the hearing. So those students are treated the same as the other students.
Okay, so Ms. Hunt, let me, before I turn it over to Ms. Wimmer-Whalen, basically our amendments do two things, and that's what we set out to do, and that's to increase the licensure from 50% to 75%, correct?
Correct.
It actually says one-half and three-fourths, but that's pretty much the same thing. And then can you explain the second part of the amendment to the committee, which is based on the testimony we heard from Vicki Chamberlain from the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission?
Yes, Chair Walker, the second part of the amendment starts on page 3. Right now what we have is that if you are teaching school in a charter school, you either have to have a regular teaching license or administrative license or be registered. So this bill is increasing the number of employees at the charter schools to 75% that have to have the regular licensure. But it's also changing the standards for registration of charter school teachers. And you see the beginning of that on page 4 of the amendment. Right now, when someone wants to be registered as a charter school teacher, they apply, and the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission can look at the criminal records check and the background check, and it's very specific, and it's very specifically directed at specific crimes. What this is broadening that check a bit. And if you look over on, let's see here, on page 5, the way it does that is the amendments talk about the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission may require an applicant for a registration to furnish evidence satisfactory to the commission that the person's good moral character, mental and physical health, and this allows the commission to get into, for example, other crimes that aren't necessarily listed in the statute specifically now would be an example. But the amendments also very specifically narrow the authority of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission in that the only thing that they can still base the approval of the registration on is the information provided as part of the background check, the criminal records check, looking at their background. Okay. So it's still more narrow than the regular license.
So currently, if you're a licensed teacher, you go through all this process with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, but if you are a registered instructor, you don't go through all this.
Chair Walker, you do submit for a criminal background check.
Okay.
Yes.
But that's all.
Right.
And so this takes it beyond that and allows the TSBC to ask those additional questions.
Correct.
Okay. And Senator Cruz has a question.
So who defines good moral character? Is that defined anywhere?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, that would be at the discretion of the commission.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's in current law?
Well.
Correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
It's in statute currently? Mm-hmm. Or is it in rule?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, I believe it's by rule. It's not defined by statute. Okay.
The words good moral character are in statute, but the definition is defined by rule. So we're not changing what's in statute. Okay. All right. That answered my questions about the amendments. We'll hear from the others. Does anybody have a question before we hear from the others? Okay. Ms. Wimmer-Whalen, tell us what's going on from
your
perspective.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. Thank you so much for this opportunity to take another look at what we were originally requesting in Senate Bill 621. As you may remember, our aspirations originally included restoration of two caps as well as collective bargaining language as well as 100% licensure. This amendment, which got guts and stuffs the original bill that we requested, simply makes parallel the requirements for the registered teachers the same expectations in terms of criminal behavior and so on that licensed teachers and administrators already have to comply with. It just makes them parallel. And it raises the threshold below that which is the average currently for charter schools in Oregon, as the testimony reflected in the last hearing. I think that testimony was in the 80 percentile range, 83%, and we're asking that 75% of teachers be credentialed. The reason the Oregon Education Association considers that a crucial piece and has always maintained
that a licensed teacher is essential in a public school setting for students' educational quality, is that licensure is a basic guarantee, minimum guarantee, and a proxy for the qualifications that make for a total classroom experience for a student. While it may be possible for someone who has expertise in diesel mechanics, for example, or HARP or ART to have subject matter knowledge, they may not be able to diagnose a learning disability. They may not have good classroom management skills. They may not have some of the other pedagogic preparation that makes for a good teacher, and that impacts the quality of learning for all students as well. And so it's been our position that public dollars that support public education and have teachers working side by side ought not have disparate expectations of that basic minimum guarantee of students as consumers have certain educational expectation protections, we would say. So as a compromise, we agreed to ask you to consider 75% as the threshold, given that we felt that that would not in any way duly disadvantage the current practice and does not even impact the current charter schools at all until renewal, and they can continue to operate as they are. But it does offer a threshold of some basic minimum performance guarantee for those educators that charter schools may hire with public dollars.
Okay, and now let's hear from Mr. Harnish, then I'm going to open it up for some questions. Mr. Harnish, specifically, this captures whom? Teachers and administrators, and how does this impact charter schools?
Mm-hmm. Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm Randy Harnish with the Department of Education, and the question, as I understand it, was the interpretation of the language, the words on page 2, lines 23 through 25. At least now three-fourths of the total full-time equivalent teaching and administrative staff. Department of Education has interpreted that over the last several years as an aggregate number of teachers and administrators, the total representative FTE of teachers and administrators, having to at least exceed 50%. So that same aggregate would apply in this situation. For example, if you had an appropriately licensed administrator, that would count towards meeting that 50 and the proposed 75% minimum, right alongside with the licensed teachers.
Okay, so does this benefit charter schools? Is it easier for them to meet the cap, or makes it more difficult?
It's the
or
same.
Any it's, change? There's
it's no
change.
It, in, as far as our interpretation, that's how we have interpreted it. That would not change in the language that we have in front of us.
Okay, great. All right, so I'll make a comment, and then I'm going to open it up for questions. I asked these amendments to be drafted because, frankly, I thought the bill, as originally drafted, was far overreaching. Clearly, from the testimony that we had at committee, it seemed to be overreaching in some minds. Now, we did have additional testimony, colleagues, from Ms. Hikas, and I'm going to have her come up here in a few minutes, that teacher licensure, 82% of Oregon's charter school teachers hold TSPC licenses appropriate for their teaching assignment. 83% are highly qualified per NCLB. And the state average is 92%. So I didn't feel 75% was too onerous. Additionally, Ms. Chamberlain had some testimony about how we need to protect our children, and she can't do it as well with just registered teachers, so this needs to reach out and capture all of the teaching personnel in the school. So that's why the amendments are before you in the way they are now. Gone is collective bargaining, gone are the caps, gone are all the onerous things that people talked about. Now, does anyone have any question about these three here before I call up some other folks? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, we're requiring one half, correct? What problem has been created? Can you demonstrate to me a lack of education in a charter school because of that requirement?
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, if that question is directed to me, I can say that we hear anecdotals, of course, about classrooms in which, especially with respect to failure to diagnose students' learning disabilities or enact the IEPs, and as our couple of my members came to testify to you, very grave difficulties in getting some of the IEPs for special education students followed, and other kinds of pedagogic side of the kinds of things that aren't given. If you don't have teacher preparation, you're not going to know how to do necessarily unless you've had some kind of alternative pathway, which is why we feel that licensure is important. It provides a basic minimum guarantee. And that testimony was provided on the record with respect to special education, but it is also the case that frequently the behavior management side is an issue.
Madam Chair, I can probably get anecdotal reports of licensed teachers with same deficiencies. So,
okay.
I mean, anecdotal is anecdotal.
Any other questions from the committee? All right. Thank you for coming up, and thank you, Ms. Hunt, for being available. Can you stay, perhaps, in case there's a question that comes up? All right, Karen, and I see Rob Kramer in the back. Would you like to testify?
In 5 minutes.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm Karen Hykus with the Charter Schools Development Center. I've brought with me today Stephanie Hinkle, who's the director of Trillium Charter School, and I hope that you will allow
her. Of which charter school?
Trillium.
Okay.
In Portland. Hope that you'll allow her to address the committee for a moment. During the March 22nd public hearing on Senate Bill 621, we urged you to oppose the bill, and before you today there are two amendments. The First Amendment that clarifies TSPC's ability to oversee charter school registered educators. We certainly support that. We don't know that the amendment actually gives them more authority, but it certainly makes it more explicit. We would certainly support anything that would increase safeguards for our students. The other amendment, which would require 75% licensure, we do oppose this amendment. And I, first of all, want to clarify my testimony on March 22nd, which indeed was that 83% of our charter school teachers are licensed, or 82% based on survey data. However, 60% of the administrators are licensed. And this amendment and the law looks at the total FTE of administrators and teachers, and right now we're at 71%. I don't think that a snapshot in time of February or March 2007 is a great basis for changing the law, but that is the snapshot in time, that we're at 71%, not 82%, because of the combination of teaching and administrative FTE. The reason we oppose this is because we think it would decrease the staffing flexibility that the law currently provides. This flexibility is critical for charter schools to keep the commitments that they make to their districts in their charter contracts, and it's critical to the innovation that charter schools provide around the state.
Okay.
We think that the staffing priority for Oregon charter schools is to hire the right people to teach the students, regardless of whether they have a license or not, and we think that's our priority as well. We're concerned about chipping away at the flexibility of the charter law, which this would do. We still think, as Senator Cruz mentioned, that this bill, even in its current form, particularly this amendment, is still a solution in search of a problem that does not exist. Also, in establishing equal or increased qualifications for charter schools without providing equal or increased funding to charter schools is an equity issue for our students, and that concerns us greatly. And that's a piece that Stephanie Hinkle would like to address. I just want to, my last comment is that the legislative intent and the introduction and the goals of the charter school law says that the law is to be interpreted liberally. And I don't think that increasing the licensure piece to 75 and restricting the flexibility is interpreting this law liberally. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'll just tell you, we've just got a couple more minutes. We're supposed to be on the floor at 10:15. I think what I'm going to do, because we don't have time to discuss this, is hold this over for another work session so that I can have a conversation with my committee, because I really want to hear your testimony. So we'll go until we get the hook.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Hinkle. I'm the director of Trillium Charter School. I'm also one of the founders. Our school is in its fifth year of operation, and we just were renewed with our district in Portland. What this 75% certification would mean to us is actually pretty dramatic. And we're in Portland, where we have a good pool of teachers to draw from, and yet for us it would mean either we choose between some of our best teachers, which three of my four administrative team teachers are not certified. They're highly qualified. They meet No Child Left Behind, but they don't meet a certification standard. And if they're the leaders in our school, they're some of, you ask the parents and the students, and even other teachers, they'll say they're some of our most qualified teachers. And I would have to choose between them or all of the support staff that I bring in to teach things like languages from native speakers and welding and dance and art and all kinds of other things that would play into this percentage that you don't necessarily have qualifications for in your staff that brings so much to students and are very critical these days in our world. The transitional licenses that exist that regular schools can use can count as a certification. It's not allowed for charter schools. So that puts another burden on us that doesn't count toward that 75% or 50%, which is a problem because we have lots of students, lots of teachers that come from other states that have gone through certification problems.
Yeah, Ms. Hingle, let me interrupt you because sure. We had a big discussion about transitional licenses, Ms. Hykus and I did, and that's being phased out by the department because I was willing to offer that in the amendments to make them apply to charter schools, and we don't need them anymore. So that argument's kind of, yeah, there you go.
She didn't tell me that. That's a good step forward. I think that if we're going to talk about equity, let's really talk about equity. Our average per student funding is about $4,600. Portland's average, which the district we're in, is about $9,400. That's a significant difference in funding, and yet we continue to be asked to do more stuff with less money. We don't get very many services that other students get because they don't have to. So when we're looking at equity, if we're really going to talk about making a level playing field with all public schools, let's really talk about all of the issues that make it a level playing field and not just one issue that's particular to one group. We have about 300 students this year. We've grown every year. We bought our building this year, which we get no help from. We don't have access to district buildings particularly, which is a major accomplishment to own a building in the state for charter schools and around the country actually. So 100% licensure would have killed our school. We would have closed. A 75% licensure will make it really not nearly as innovative and creative and exciting environment as it is now. We offer so many exciting things to students. They're very engaged. We have a really high retention rate. Students and families love our school. We're doing lots of great things. We create leaders all the time. And this would really hamper our efforts to do that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Kramer, you've got about 2 minutes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rob Kramer with the Oregon Education Coalition, and I also represent the League of Oregon Charter Schools. I will be very brief because I know time is short. I'd simply like to say that when I first heard of these amendments, I said that I would go check with our member charter schools to see if this is a compromise that they could live with. And we got feedback from them, and the answer was pretty universally, no, it's not. 75%, although we do appreciate the OEA having these amendments and backing off some of the provisions in the original bill.
Yeah, I think the OEA has been very generous here.
And we do appreciate that.
Pulling back some of these things that they wanted, which I think they were legitimate to ask for.
Madam Chair, we appreciate that as well. And that's why I, in good faith, went to ask our member schools if they can live with 75%. The reality of the matter is, especially for the new schools, the startup schools that may have three teachers, 75% means 100% because it's not flexible enough to have one non-certified teacher in a group of three. And so it hurts the schools at the most critical phase, which is when they are starting, when they're very, very small. And as Karin pointed out, We are at 83% if we just look at certified teachers, but adding administrators into the mix, we're already below the 75% threshold. We're at 71%. Now, that said, the other provisions of this bill and the amendments, the registration, adding the registered teachers under the umbrella of all the disciplinary processes, we are fine with that. We think that's responsible thing to do, and anything that adds to the safety of our kids, we are more than happy to support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Thank all of you. I appreciate that you came down. And so I need to have a conversation with the committee. We all need to have a conversation together, so I'm going to set it for another work session so that we can do that in a public setting. Meanwhile, I'll talk to my committee members separately as well. But I do appreciate your testimony. I think that the OEA has valid concerns that they spend all this time going to school. My son's about ready to start graduate school to be a teacher. So he's putting the money out, he's putting the time in, and he's going to become a licensed teacher. And they feel it's important, and if it's public money, they believe it should be a licensed teacher. But in charter school law, we've given an accommodation here. I think they just want to see that accommodation come up a little bit. So I think we can probably have some more conversation about that. Thank you. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 621. Since
Karen?
Yes, sir.
We're still in committee. I'm sorry.
Oh, Rio, are you?
No.
Okay. I will appreciate my committee's indulgence, and we'll talk about this again. Thank you. We're adjourned.